So, Zazen of the body. A couple of things before we start. First, there's a whole spectrum of beneficial Zen practices, maybe going from the power of mindfulness at one end to the more mystical end of Zen Buddhism. And today's talk is at the mystical end. So if you're at some other place on the spectrum, good and fine. And I hope you can find some things that are interesting anyway. Second, if there is a takeaway from today's talk, it is likely to be about the power of resistance, of going against the grain. And I thought it might be helpful to give you a bit of an understanding of that before we enter into the more formal talk. I was a college teacher for a while. I spent, as you know, some of you know, I spent 7 years at Shasta Abbey as a monk, and went back to university afterwards and did some college teaching. One of the books I used to work with my college student was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. People love this book. And after I'd used it a couple of times, I started to use it differently. The first week, I would ask students to read the book and reference three sections of the text, give me the quotations, and tell me, what it was that they liked about that. And then the next week, I'd ask them to do the reverse. You say, as you go through the book, mark three sections that you don't like, or that you disagree with, or that you find a little bit upsetting, and say a little bit about that. So I call that second reading, reading against the grain. Some spot, some place where you get a little bit of an internal friction, when you read the book. Like, what's going on here? It's like, I want to skip over that part and get to this part here that I really like. So. Okay, so after a couple of years of that, I got a different job. I was, one more thing about that. In grad school, I read some of Thomas Kuhn's work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He did a lot of work studying the whole Copernican shift, how we used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe, and then we shifted to moving to the sun as the center of the universe. So he had some advice for us in reading the ancient texts in the history of science. And he says, when you're reading those ancient texts, don't focus on the 90% you understand. Look to the 10% you don't understand. He says, when you can understand that 10%, the other 90% will have a completely different meaning. That's a little bit more on against the grain. Okay, so then I got another job as a director of a comparative religion and culture program. And I went with the students. They did 10 weeks in Japan, 10 weeks in India, 10 weeks in Israel, with breaks in Thailand and Nepal. So these are American college students. And the challenge for me was, well, how as an American program, do we go to these different countries and do more than simply folding our new experiences into our already existing American sensibilities? So I came up with this idea, at least I thought I was being innovative at the time. And I said, okay. To the students, to my students, I want you to imagine that you're hooked up to one of those hospital machines. It's got all these little sensors, and there's a little charge going beep, 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 and showing all your bodily reactions to what's going on, and it's spewing out a chart. So I want you to imagine that you're hooked up to one of those, but it's a portable machine, and it goes everywhere you go. Okay, so it's constantly spewing out this chart. as we have our little adventures in Japan and Kyoto. Said, okay, at the end of the week, I want you to take this chart. I want you to mark the highest points and the lowest points and circle those to see if you'd give me a two-page paper on one of those. Okay, so what we have going on here is an attempt to read the culture through the body. So, okay, why don't you do that every week for 10 weeks and then take all of those papers, look at them again, and see if you can connect the dots. So they did that in Japan. They did that in India. They did that in Israel. And at the end of the year, I gave them a big assignment with a couple of pages of questions and had them look at all 30 pages and see if they can connect the larger dots, if they can triangulate the self and see what's going on here. Different countries, Japan, India, Israel, same self, same body. Okay, so that's an attempt then to get outside of our normal sensibilities and somehow work at our experiences slightly differently. Okay, again, I thought I was being innovative there, and then later I realized that this was simply a takeoff from my years of doing Shosan at Shasta Abbey. I did it twice a month for 6 years. And the last couple of years, really what I did was I started asking questions differently. I started asking questions based on those dissonances. Like I was hooked up to one of those charts. And I was marking those spots that were troubling or dissonant in my interactions at the monastery and asking a question about one of those. Okay. Like many of you, I began Zen practice through thoughts or the breath. This is the best starting point and the foundation of practice. But just for today, what if we use the body as a lens, as an entry point? Now, this talk actually began out of a Q&A session from my last talk about 6 months ago, and I was asked a couple of questions. One woman asked, how do I get more into my body? And another woman asked, what's the difference between thoughts and feelings? And I answered both of those questions, and afterwards I thought I didn't do a very good job. And I thought about those questions, especially that one, the differences between thoughts and feelings. I thought about that for 6 months. A lot. I thought about it, shopping in the grocery store for cereal. I think, what's the difference between thoughts and feelings? You know. Okay, so what I realized was that I think it is true that you can treat some feelings as if they are thoughts. So you're doing Zazen or whatever, and you have a feeling of sadness, and the metaphor here, usually clouds in the sky, clouds move through the sky, the sadness moves through, maybe you're feeling happiness. So sometimes there is this rather free flow of emotions that is not too dissimilar to dusting thoughts off a mirror. So not exactly the same, but close enough. So I realized that wasn't the distinction I was trying to make. The distinction I was trying to make was between feelings and layered feelings. That's the distinction. Now, this concept of layered feelings is easiest to understand through either novels or movies. I think I read a short story once. Grandfather is going for a vacation to the family's cabin in Vermont on a lake, and he's there with his family, and he looks out over the lake and he sees his grandson standing on a raft about to dive into the water. And he flashes back to watching his son, the son's father, doing that same dive and remembering back to when he was a boy and making that same dive into the water. So what you have are three generations going on in this same moment. It is in the novel, written much better than I'm explaining it now, but I think you get a sense of it, how that moment for the grandfather had this extra layer of richness to it, because of it was layered with these other memories and feelings. Now, we can go a different way, and movies are best for this. The main character, will make her a mother, is having an argument with her teenage daughter, and then the movie cuts to when the mother was a little girl and having that same argument with her mother. And maybe the mother says, oh my God, I'm turning into my mother, or something like this. So there's something going on in that moment other than what's happening in the present. The past is actually present. The emotional past is present in that present moment. There are layers there. We can go further than that, have a couple more layers. So here's my question. Where does that layered memory go when we jump out of that scene? Is it gone? Well, for today, the answer is no, it's not gone. It's hidden in the space between thoughts. So there was some talk a couple of lectures ago in the Q&A about the space between thoughts. Sometimes the space between thoughts is short. Sometimes the space between thoughts is longer. But what's going on in that space between thoughts? So what I'm saying today is that space between thoughts, it has an inclination, a leaning, a vibration, or a resonance that could be other than it is. So just for today, let's envision that space between thoughts as a string on a musical instrument that can be tuned, or a space that holds hidden intensities with great possibility. Okay. Let's move now formally into Buddhism here. And I have a few examples here. The first comes from the very first lecture I heard Jiu Kennett give. She actually used this pink book, and not this exact pink book, but one just like it. And she quoted from it with page and verse, which is really unusual. I actually can't remember her ever doing that. So anyway, I marked it down in my book, and we have it here in my 30 or 40 year old writing with actually very nice penmanship. I don't write like that anymore. Let me read it out to you. It's about the Buddhist view of death. The Buddhist belief is that, as a rule, the thought, volition, or desire, which is extremely strong during lifetime, becomes predominant at the point of death and conditions the subsequent birth. It, in this last thought moment, is present a special potentiality. Now, I've read this before, but I didn't emphasize this last phrase. In this last thought moment is present a special potentiality. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that in the Buddhist theory of the bardo realms is that the Buddhist priests doing the memorial or funeral ceremony has the possibility to turn that thought, to kind of talk to the being in the bardo realm and work with that last thought, volition, or desire and turn it like do acupuncture on it, or turn it like melt it, or turn it like invert it, or turn it upside down. That's what it means that that last thought moment has a special potentiality. Now, most of us in the West don't believe in rebirth, but if we did, what we might believe is that when we are born, that that last thought, volition, wish, desire comes as we are born. That's written on the body. It's like a scar or a wound or a wrinkle or a ripple, and it exists between thoughts. It's in that space between thoughts so that things can land on it. And it has special potentiality. That's the part I keep forgetting that's really important. Okay. One of the things I noticed, I think as anybody does who does some travel to Asia, is that the cultural context in which Buddhism is studied and practiced is completely different than it is in the West. And one of the big differences in the cultural context is with the view of the body. So they have a cultural context of the body that's really quite different than the dominant view here in the West. And we have this notion about Western medicine and Eastern medicine, but let me just talk about two. First, Kundalini Yoga. I've heard of this before I went to the monastery. And in my beginner's understanding, Kundalini Yoga was a practice of dissolving blocks in the chakras, the seven chakras, so that life energy might move freely through those blocks up to the spine into the crown of the head. And of course, I thought this has nothing to do with Zen practice, because as many of us do in the West, we tend to compartmentalize and keep these things all separate from one another. So, a few months into my first year at the monastery, Gio Kennett brought us all into the dining room for another lecture on how to set up a Zen practice. And this one was how to set up the buildings at a Zen monastery. She said that the monastery building should be mapped out as if on a human body. The latrines and the baths are the left and right legs. The training hall and the kitchen are the left and right arms. And on the central vertical axis, the Dharma hall is the head, the Buddha hall is the heart, and the main gate, the mountain gate, is between the legs in the genitals. Now, I have to say at that time, I was very surprised to hear my teacher use the word genitals, but she did. And I didn't know quite what to do about that. And it wasn't till later that I found out that Hindu temples in India are arranged around and mapped on the seven chakras. The kind of successive movement through the temple is through the seven chakras. So it seems highly probable that the Buddhists basically took that from the Hindus and kind of set out the Buddhist monasteries in the same way. Now, I brought this up before in a class, and I said, do people know about this? And many people in the class did, but I realized I asked the wrong question. Basically, the question isn't, do you know about this? The question is, really, does this view of the chakras inform your practice? That's the question. In other words, does this notion that energy moves up the spine through the blocks, does that inform our practice? I think for most of us, it doesn't. But I have to wonder if in the East, at least in some places, it's understood differently, like this notion of the body having blocks and energy moving up the spine, if that's kind of just part of the culture, one that most of us don't have here. Okay, the second one here is a similar point, is Chinese acupuncture, the Chinese medicine. Again, I had a superficial understanding of the tradition before I went to the monastery, envisioning the body as a luminous body lined with a series of 12 or 16 meridians, many named after body organs, kidney, bladder, spleen, that may be out of balance or blocked and in need of harmonizing. I mean, that's kind of a rough outline I had. So some of the resistance and negativity in daily life might be as a result of a block in our body, something frozen in that space between thoughts. Of course, I didn't think this had anything to do with Zen practice. However, later I discovered in Zen Master Dogen's Zazen Shin, which I originally thought was about the heart of Zazen, it's actually translated the acupuncture needle of Zazen. What if Zazen functions as an acupuncture needle working on those blocks in the body? That particular fascicle chapter of the Shobogenzo has language like the essential pivot, pivotal essence, turning moment or phrase. It really, I think, is better understood as talking about an energetics of Zen practice. So in this view, those hindrances or blocks or portals or pivot points, again, with special potentiality. In a good sense, a good hindrance can be like the ox in the beginning of the 10 ox herding pictures. We spend the first few frames of the ox herding pictures searching for our ox. When we find our ox, do we dust it off our mirror? Or understand now is the time to wrestle with it and maybe ride it home. Okay, so a few months after after what I think of in my mind, this Jiu Kennett's genitals lecture, Roshi Daisui gave a lecture on the body, speaking about these meridians. And he encouraged us, he said, do some detective work. And those of you who know a little bit about Chinese medicine know there's a very sophisticated framework of doing this kind of research on the body that has to do with, well, you know, are you waking up at the particular time in the middle of the night? Are there some foods that, you know, you have a particular preference or aversion to? There's some season of the year that you kind of thrive on or kind of go low? And then he said, or are there any scars on your body? I have this huge scar on my left side. So when he said that, I perked up. And he said, scars can trap memories of pain and suffering that will release when you're able to handle them. And here again, there's this notion of a wound or a flaw or a block that has some special potentiality. And that's when Roshi Daisui used that phrase, spiritual transformation is the transformation of the body. Oh, and for this next section, I need my help from Daigai. I brought along a tanka from the Tibetan tradition. Maybe you can just hold it up here. Yeah, for a minute. I'm sure some of you have seen versions of this before. This is a very classic teaching aid. It's a version of what is sometimes called the Wheel of Life. It's also called the Six Realms of Desire. And this particular one is one of my favorites. My mother, a long time ago, she did some work for the Bhutanese government. And this is a Bhutanese tanka. It's painted by an apprentice because they don't let you take the old ones out of the country. But they're training people to pass on the whole skills. And I like this particular one. Because it's a little sloppy. And by sloppy, I don't mean that it's not painted precisely. It's that if you're familiar with this, there are six realms here, and there's usually these sharp lines between the six realms. And usually you see these Buddha images, which I will call portals, and usually they're situated exactly in the middle of the realms. But this one, you have a couple here like painted on the border. And if you don't know this, it can be interpreted in any number of ways. But for today, it's often interpreted as the different realms of desire that we might go through in the day or the week. Pride, hate, anger, jealousy, anxiety, fear. These all, of course, craving, all correspond to different realms. And there's a Buddha in each realm. But the thing I like about this is the possibility that, for instance, anger and jealousy, maybe they're not separate realms. Maybe we sometimes have a jealous anger, that some of our emotions are sloppy. And I like that sloppiness. So this, again, I'm going to use this to make the same point that each of these realms, each of these intense emotions, in a sense, has a special potentiality because there is a Buddha portal in each realm. There is access to the Buddha realm out of each of these emotions. I have just a short reading here from Chogyam Trungpa, his book on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I like his writings because when he came to the West, he had to make a decision about what language he would use. And he decided to use the language of psychology. So his stuff is a little easier to understand. The realm of the gods, that's this one right up top, also happens in our daily life experiences. Whenever we are absorbed in a spiritual state, a trance-like state of joy or pleasure, involved in our own self and its projections, whenever that joy comes, there's also the possibility of its opposite, the centerless, all-pervading quality of Vairochana. That's the Buddha portal. It is extremely irritating, not at all attractive, because there's nothing to indulge in, no basic ground in which we can enjoy ourselves. It is all very well to have a panoramic vision of openness, but if there's no one to perceive it, it is terrible from the point of view of the ego. Now, he goes on to talk about, he makes this distinction about desires with a center and desires without a center. And in a sense, they are the same, in the same sense that in Buddhism, the passions are the wisdoms. But one has a center and one does not. So some negative states are actually blocked or frozen, love or joy. And that's the notion of special potentiality. And what we think of as a block, well, it is a block, but it has special potential as frozen love or joy. Okay, we'll stop there. Yeah, if we could maybe walk it up to the cameras there, which I understand are not working very well.
Better.
All right. I'll leave this at the front of the hall for 10 minutes or so after the talk if people want to come up and have a look. Okay, following Trungpa's example, this notion of the search for language, I'd like to move into briefly the language of therapy and some time ago, when I was still living in New York City, I had a 3-year relationship with a couples therapist. And during the time we lived together, she had her 300 books on couples therapy and desire on one side of the room, and I had my 300 books on Buddhism and Zen on the other side of the room. So I want you to imagine that we took all of these books and put them in a blender. And then what you would come up with is this book, Undefended Love. So since I'm not a therapist, I'm not going to comment on this. But what I have done is I've selected 2 minutes of quotations from the book. I'm just going to read them out from beginning to end. So this is, next part is not me talking, although it is, but it's all undefended love. Chapter 10, dissolving our defenses. We must turn and face all the places where we are stuck, wounded, withholding, and contracted. We must work directly with all that we fear, resist, vilify, disown, and reject. We will discover that the capacity to love with an undefended heart comes from the willingness to turn toward our fear and endure what St. John called the dark night of the soul. It takes many transits through this process to soften the thickest parts of our armor. And a great joy awaits us once we know the way and gain confidence in its rewards. The journey becomes an adventure that we actually seek out. It means stretching to stay open, even if shutting down is our main line of defense. It even means staying with feeling bad, inadequate, less than, or lacking, without doing something to distract ourselves so that we can feel better. Every emotional state can be an entry point to an intimate experience of ourselves and another if we can learn to recognize it and make use of it. All of our reactions, behaviors, thoughts, feelings can serve this purpose, as can all the places where we feel stuck, blocked, or stopped in our tracks. You begin where you are. In the end, the level of peace, love, and pleasure we are capable of enjoying corresponds to the depth of emotional pain we can tolerate. It is our depth that defines the fullness and intensity of intimacy we can experience. In a sense, this is a bit like yoga. We don't have to tear any muscles in this process, but we must stretch beyond our prior stage of comfort. The attitude of compassion is our guide. It is our sacred escort to the truth of ourselves. And reading. Okay, I'm not going to comment on that because I'm not a therapist, but the language, I think, might be useful to some people. Okay, part two, how to work with the body. Lots of answers here. Here are a few of mine. One, in the really old days in the 70s, I was very involved with what came to be called the human potential movement. And if some of you are as old as I am, or maybe from your parents or grandparents, you think of the Esalen Institute in California. And actually, some of the people from the Esalen Institute moved to Canada, to Cortez Island, set up the Cold Mountain Institute, which is where I went, which just by chance happened to be just a ferry ride or two from where I went to high school. A lot of the teachers there went there and back. Anyway, there was this pretty significant movement into this kind of work with yourselves that it came to be called the human potential movement, that things like encounter groups and gestalt dream therapy and yoga and tai chi and the Feldenkrais method and freeform dance and any number of things. It was a big part of my life for a while. So the reason I'm mentioning that is because we were cultivating a certain approach to feeling. So I have to mention that because it's not what I'm talking about today, but you have to understand that. I think that many of us came to Cold Mountain, some of us from families where not a lot of emotion was shared. And the practice was to be the feelings. You know, I'm feeling angry, be the anger. You know, and you've seen on the TV the pillow fights and things like that. You want to step into your emotion and be the feelings. Well, for some of us, this was like extremely liberating. And there actually, this is a practice where there's a certain fluidity in and out of your feelings that's really quite remarkable. And at the time, I have to confess, I think some of us even thought this was a form of Zen practice. I was at one with my body, with my feelings. Later, I think people might call it no filter Zen. Be the feeling. And we even went further. If I think it, I have to say it. Of course, it only worked within our small group. You take this outside, you're in a lot of trouble. Okay, so be the feeling. Okay, so from there, I went to Shasta Abbey, and we had a different approach to feeling there. And I remember distinctly sitting with the novice master, with a group of novices, and basically it was, just because anger is arising doesn't mean you have to be angry. Completely the opposite of what I thought we were supposed to be doing at Cold Mountain. Now, this distinction is really important, so I hope you can get it in your mind. Just because anger is arising doesn't mean you have to be angry. And so there's this notion of a good Buddhist metaphor. A match is struck and it flames up, but you don't have to fuel it. And if you don't fuel it, it'll die down. So some of the questions at Shosan, how can I get better at working with my anger? That would be a good question. I'm so angry, what can I do about it? This is not a good question at a monastery. Okay, that's when you're taken aside by the novice master and you say, anger is arising, you don't have to be anger. So this ability to separate, to create a gap between you and your feelings is crucial. That's number two. Okay, that's not quite what I'm talking about either. So this is where it gets, I think, difficult and tricky. I think that this business of anger is arising, I think you can use that for feelings that come and go, like sadness or happiness. I don't think it works for layered feelings. I don't think it works for this scar or wound with special potentiality that exists in the gap between thoughts. Something else is going on there. So. Here's where we move to another classic Buddhist metaphor, which is the water and ice, which works very well for this talk. I forgot how Hakuin's Song of Zazen goes, but it's like something like beings to Buddha nature as ice is to water, that we all have that potential. At least as I read the poem, but it's a little frozen. Okay, so let's think about those blocks in the space between thoughts as ice cubes. So then how do we work with them? Imagine holding a bowl of warm water in your hands. Now we all have icy parts. So now imagine putting one of your icy parts in the warm water. Okay, warm water, icy part. Now, how does it feel to be the ice melting? Now, you might think it quickly, it feels pretty good. But if you've ever put ice into warm water, you know there's a lot of kicking and sputtering and cracking going on. Okay, the ice is losing its identity, its solidity. Okay, there is actually some resistance there, because the way in which I have engaged the world as this solidity is beginning to dissolve. So it's actually, there's some discomfort there as the ice begins to dissolve. We might call it armor or shields. Many of our shields were constructed for very good reason. We know ice can crack and splinter under warm water. What form might this cracking and sputtering take? For me, towards the end of my first year, my left eye started to water. I get these little drops of water. I wasn't crying. It's just like water. It's like my eye was leaking. It's very strange. I get wet cheeks, and then started to leak more. And then it was both eyes. And then there was some sadness. And then I started like crying in the cemetery, and actually crying. Get these pains in my toes. Stuff started to happen in my body. Now let's switch sides. What is the attitude of mind the warm water takes to the ice? We want to be the warm water that welcomes the ice cubes. Here's the trick. You need to be both the ice and the warm water. This is the difficult part. It takes a lot of practice. Experiment with finding the right distance, the right feeling, the right approach. And it takes some oscillation. Some of you may have heard Gyoshi's talk on spiritual bypassing a way back. And I have to say, I think this is part of it. You know, there's this Zen saying here that fits very well: not too close, not too far away. Okay? If it's too far away, well, there's no melting going on. If it's too close, I think there needs to be some distance, needs to be in the right place. You need to be able to hold that memory, that emotional memory, in the right place. And again, you'll make some mistakes on either side. I'm going to call them mistakes. It's not mistakes, it's trial and error. Bow to the resistance so you can sink into it from the inside. Practice how best to hold the discomfort and dissonance, as there is an art to it. Not too close, not too far away. We have to both be the discomfort and hold it in our hands at the same time. There is a sweet spot. We are here to learn to love ourselves and each other for our icy parts, because the true nature of ice is warm, luminous, and flowing water. Those icy parts could be frozen joy, a knotted energy that can be released, a clenched fist that can open, a frozen bud that is waiting to flower. Okay, last section, the light of Buddha. I've made this process complicated, but it need not be at all. The light of Buddha is increasing in brilliance, and the wheel of the Dharma is always turning. This is happening whether we like it or not. The light of Buddha is always shining on us, always doing its own special warm watering. Imagine this entire Zendo as a bowl of warm water, and we're all sitting in it together. Maybe this is what we are doing when we come here to do Zazen on Sunday mornings. We are being warm watered. And sometimes for a few of us, our icy parts react to that warm watering. There are big blocks of ice and there are tiny ice cubes. Start small. Start with your response to the guy who cuts you off in traffic. What's going on there? Certainly, you got to have that experience, that little tug. you know, how to work with that. Start really small. Pick something really small. Every ice cube we melt increases our capacity for love and joy. This is why when senior students find a block of ice, they say, oh, goody, because they know on the other side of discomfort is an increased capacity to feel and express love and joy. The process is generative, like riding a bicycle. We are generating the loving heat we need to continue the process. Our bowl of warm water grows a tiny bit warmer and a tiny bit larger. Take refuge in the warm water of the Sangha. Maybe some of you were here for the Dharma school graduation ceremony. As if the whole Zendo was a bowl of warm water, the collective warmth of the Sangha treasure. Thank you. Questions, comments?
And we'll bring the microphone to you. Please say your first name. And if you have a question on Zoom, then Tony can either unmute you or read your question off in the chat.
I'm Dai Guy. So I've heard the oh goody thing before from you, and you know, what you said just now is that what energizes that is that there's this knowledge that on the other side of that is something favorable. But there's an intermediate place, it seems like, where you don't even need that thing on the other side. There's a certain joy in encountering the ice and actually the experience of it melting without anything thereafter. Can you say something about that? Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do. I think you put it well. Actually, they do it much better in this book. Because not everyone's on the other side. You know, I hadn't experienced the other side. But I think that that having some idea of the process is of immense value in following through with the practice.
And there's that joy of learning, right? Of just seeing something that was unseen in the past. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Alice. Thank you for your talk. I'm just wondering whether you can talk more about the warm water, because when you talk about what is in my mind came up with me is the water become cold. I put the ice in and the warm water become room temperature water. And sooner or later become cold water, or maybe ice. So can you talk more about the warm water side, please?
The warm water. Yeah. Well, that's a really good question. I didn't include it in this talk, but I'm one of the big practice examples for me was when I was in the monastery, and part of the practice there is you bow to your seniors, and it has absolutely nothing to do with any judgment about whether or not these people are worthy of being bowed to. And so there's some people I didn't get along with very well, and that's actually part of the deal. You have to have that. So, you know, my father is probably a better example than some of these seniors at the monastery. How do I make that bow? Because there is I would have to say, an absence of the feeling of warm water at that point. So, and I don't know whether this answers your question, but I guess there's sometimes you have to take the warm water on faith, because what you're feeling is not, what I'm feeling is not warm. It's that really active resistance. Is that helpful? Or
I
don't
know.
Say more.
I guess I'm just wondering how much can I melt the ice? Sooner or later, I don't have warm water. And how do I maintain my warm water?
How do I maintain my warm water? I don't, yeah, I don't think you can do that. I like this word oscillation. I really like it a lot. So this kind of going in and going out. So maybe it's better to think of sometimes I'm the warm water and sometimes I'm not, but I have to put my identity in the warm water even when I'm not feeling it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Erin. I have a degree in marriage and family therapy, so they'll let me treat couples, but I don't want to. I was just wondering, when I talk about like romantic love with people who know a little bit about Buddhism, there's this like criticism that comes up of the idea of attachment and like attachment meaning that you can't love or that you're not supposed to get too like fixated on one person, basically. Do you have anything to say on that that you haven't already said? I tend to respond to that with, you know, the differences between compassionate love and possessiveness. But I don't know if there's something else I should be saying.
That's a really big question.
Yeah.
It's a really good one.
I'll buy the book.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that'd be a good thing to do. Buddhism has two loves. Basically, there's an attached and an unattached. And what's so difficult for us to understand in the West, and what I would say here is that they can be the inside out of one another. So the power of that attachment, it's actually possible for the power of that attachment to generate this process. There's an inside out to the power of that attachment. Roshi Daiswis, he's good at this. I have a quotation from him I like a lot. a student comes to Roshi Daiswis and says something like this: "Goes, is it best to love unattached?" And Roshi Daiswi says, "Well, yes, but mainly it's best just to love." I like that answer.
Me too. Quick question. I missed a word that you said. You said that scars can hold memories of pain that are released when, I thought you said when you die, but I don't know if that's right.
Oh, no. Yeah.
That sounded wrong.
No, I think Roshi Daiswi was preparing us, young people at the monastery, that part of the practice at the monastery might be that some of us who had scars might find that those scars were releasing the painful memories from earlier in our lives.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, on Zoom, there's a question that someone is asking just to tell us the name of the book you've been referring to in the past few questions.
Undefended Love.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Benny. Thank you for your talk. I appreciate especially you touching upon the mysticism of Buddhism. I feel like that's something that kind of gets left upon. Especially for me, I come from a culture where my Chinese family, they kind of do practices that are adjacent to Buddhism, and I see it. And I've always seen it as kind of superstitious, like you talk about the different structuring of like feng shui and positioning things. It always seemed like kind of weird and not aligned with how Buddhism is to me. But I can see how it can be kind of a manifestation of karma, or like they're trying to affect why we do these practices, that they're hoping for a better afterlife, a better rebirth, or for me to have a better life. Could you talk about that, like karma? How does that play into all this?
Let me say two things quickly. One, One of the most powerful experiences I had when I was traveling with my students was in Taipei, when they took me to one of the three-in-one temples, where they practiced Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism side by side. And, you know, in my world religion textbooks, each of those have like different chapters and different categories. So the thought that they would be all mushed together was like, whoa! And it was another one of those times when I realized that how compartmentalized my thinking was. As for karma, I mean, that's just a really complex subject. And here again, we get into the issue of language, because I did a quick search online, but I wanted to have a way of distinguishing between feelings and layered feelings. And I think you can use the word karma to refer to both, but I'm sure that in the Buddhist lexicon of terms, there's a way of distinguishing between those two those two categories of karma.
Thank you.
Oh, are we running out of time? Okay.
This is Amy. Thank you for your talk. It was helpful when you prefaced your comments today about saying you were contrasting feelings and thoughts. And then you've also talked about layered feelings. Are layered feelings, as you're describing them, thoughts?
No. I mean, they might have some thought component, but there is a kind of emotional depth to them. I want to stay away from the word trauma, because that moves too heavily into therapy, but it has that kind of in the bones feeling to it.
So then, like, in a sentence, if it's possible, how would you describe thoughts in sort of opposition to feeling?
Well, to use the classic Buddhist example of the dust on a mirror, thoughts you can dust off the mirror. The deep feelings that I'm talking about, they're in the mirror itself, and the thoughts land on them.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you for your talk.
I think we're running out of time here. So maybe if there's one more question.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the talk. This is really opening a lot of churning emotions, feelings, and things. And one of the combinations that you're putting together is the image of warmth being pleasant. I don't get it that it's pleasant. I just get it that's what's so. So when I think of ice in the warm water, I get that it's a very churning mess. The ice is freezing some of the water that's next to it, and it's going back and forth in ways, melting, freezing, and it's very rapid. And the rest of the warmth that's around it is struggling to maintain that. And outside of this is more coming in, kind of like the temperature in the room might be 75 degrees, but outside it's cold. And the radiation loss out through the walls actually reaches us. And that's kind of going on in this churning warm water, right? And it's always evolving and changing. You know, like, this is really intriguing. Because as we get done, it's this churning that is actually what we're there for. And I don't know where it's going to go. It's really exciting. The metaphors we're using, I find also exciting, in that the layered feelings also looks like it's a stagnant way of, well, I don't mean stagnant, static way of looking at what's happening, where when I have them myself, they're all at the same time. Is that so?
Oh, well, you've said a lot of things there. So if I think I can agree with you, it's probably a far more complicated than I said, and that my metaphor of layered feelings could be better. But I think that, yes, in that moment of experience, and those layered feelings kind of collapse into one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just reminded me of one Star Trek episode where they're asking, how do you tell where a Class M planet is, where it just means where there's life? And he said, oh, we just look for a drop in entropy. And I'm like, is that even possible?
So I can't comment on Star Trek episodes. So I'll have to save that or refer it to someone else.
So I'm looking at the entropy that we have that's constantly going on in our warm bath. As we're bringing life into it, the energy improves and increases, and it no longer fits the static loss of energy and input. So we make a difference.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that was it.
Okay, thank you. And thank you.